The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating more than a half century of promoting awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Korea Society. Welcome to Studio Korea, and welcome to the Samsung Center. It is our pleasure today to continue the series, The Analysts. We're halfway through the series, and today we welcome Dr. Sue Terry, known for all of her excellent work in writing, for her work at Columbia University with Gerson Global Advisors, and previously her work for the National Intelligence Office, for the National Security Council, for the Central Intelligence Agency, and Sue is a graduate of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. Sue, welcome. We're delighted to have you here at the Korea Society. And we are joined today by a marvelous, intimate audience. I'd like to acknowledge a few members of our board who are here today. Dr. Kim Young-duk, YD Kim, thank you for coming. Lee Snyder and Rud Potz, thank you very much for your joining us today. And Ambassador Ham, the Deputy Permanent Representative from the Republic of Korea to the United Nations, thank you for honoring us with your presence, and all of you for taking time here on this noon hour to listen to Sue and her observations on something that has become very hot again in dialogue, and that is the emphasis on unification going forward. This year has been an interesting one in that Korean President Park Geun-hye started early in the year by talking about the notion of a unification bonanza. Sue captured quite a bit of attention through foreign affairs and an important piece called A Korea Whole and Free. And we'll talk about that piece. We'll talk about some of the reaction to it. And then we have this new presidential committee for unification preparation, which has had two meetings to date in Korea, which is establishing a framework, which will be visiting New York City through some of its representatives. And so there's a currency to this dialogue that is interesting and one that the Korea Society is very much supportive of. So Sue, welcome and congratulations on the piece and all the attention you've gotten from it. Could you guide us through a bit in terms of the piece and your approach?
Sure. Well, first, thank you, Stephen, and thank you to the Korea Society for inviting me here today. It's a privilege to be here, always a pleasure. You've done a marvelous job with this program, thank you so much. Before I talk about the piece, I wonder if I could just sort of talk about something that's my approach and
sure,
basic thing about North Korea. As you mentioned, I spent my entire adult life and most of my career following North Korean issues. And spent 12, 13 years at the CIA as a North Korea analyst monitoring North Korea with all available intelligence information. And then spent some time at the policy side and now in academia interacting with renowned Korea watchers and debating and discussing. And I can tell you one thing with certainty about North Korea, and that is we know very little about what really goes on at the leadership level and regime intentions level. I mean, we know reshuffling and who's doing what, but the real dynamics under with the leadership. And I mentioned this because I want to say something before I talk about the unification is that no one knows the timeline for when that's going to happen. And so I'm not saying that regime implosion is about to happen or the unification is about to happen. No one knows that. But that said, because we know so little about North Korea, and I don't care who you are, we don't. I mean, we can only speculate. So that said, while Kim Jong-un regime and this North Korean state can last another 50 years, 40 years, 30 years, and I just don't know when the timeline is, I would not be surprised either if it were to fall apart tomorrow or 6 months from now or a year from now, because all the conditions for potential instability have been there, and you know that. So all the pillars of stability, what kept the regime going, have been eroding for some time, and no one can deny that either, right? And what are some of these pillars of stability? We talk about elite loyalty or support, because the leadership really needs the elite support, not the populace elite support. Information, monopoly on information, and ideological indoctrination, whether it's foreign assistance or security service. We have these pillars of stability. All of them have been eroding. I mean, we just even know, let's talk about the elite loyalty support. Kim Il-sung had elite loyalty. Kim Jong-il had what we call elite support. I try to differentiate between loyalty and support because it has a different nuance, right? And yes, Kim Jong-un seems like he has some support, elite support, because obviously elites have vested interest in keeping the status quo, in keeping the system going. Their fate is locked with Kim Jong-un. But it's not the kind of loyalty that we've seen before. And it's not, and even the support, I mean, there's a lot going on under the lid. I think Chang Sung-taek's execution and all the reshuffling that's been going on at least show us that there's so much that we don't know and there's something is going on there. And we can at least question whether there's elite unity. There's definitely disunity going on, right, with Chang Sung-taek's execution. And even today we just heard that somebody else has been executed from the... So while my only point is that I would not be surprised. So my point of the Foreign Affairs article was this, that first of all, because we know very little, and it could happen, North Korea is undoubtedly the world's most failed state. And historical record shows that failed states cannot last forever. So at some point, this is going to happen. We just don't know when. So my point of the article was, let's focus on preparing for disunification, which is so important. Yes, we do have military plans in place. U.S. has a military plan to respond to a conflict with North Korea, war scenario. South Korea obviously has plans to even deal with North Korea in case of regime implosion. But we don't have the kind of plan, a comprehensive plan, that legal, economic, diplomatic plan to complement the military plan. And we need to get going on that because we don't know when it's going to happen. And another point that I was trying to make with the article was that I'm not trying to minimize the challenges and the consequences or put all the potential problems that unification will entail or regime implosion or regime collapse or the consequences of negative consequences of that potential scenario. I'm not trying to minimize that either. I spent majority of my time when I was working in the government looking at all the things that could go wrong. But I've been feeling that because of all this over-focus and all the things that could go wrong, right? Humanitarian disaster, potential refugee flows, what we're gonna do about the Korean People's Army, potentially lose nukes. There are a lot of things that could go wrong. But we haven't really spent time looking at the flip side of it, which is that I'm not denying all these challenges in the immediate and short, or even medium term, but what's going to happen in the long term? Mm-hmm. And that's what I think, this is when I was bringing up some potential benefits of unification. Never mind humanitarian benefit, number one, freeing 25 million North Korean people from the grip of the last remaining Stalinist dictatorship. We don't talk enough about human rights. But what about these people? So that's immeasurable, that benefit alone, right? Mm-hmm. 80 to 120,000 political prisoners that are now sitting in the gulags, freeing these people, moving them out of this starvation diet, right? Literally and intellectually out of this food shortages and too plentiful availability of food and information and consumer goods and other benefits of modern capitalism. So besides the humanitarian benefit, we all know about the security benefit. North Korea is the biggest potential for instability in Northeast Asia. We have so many concerns about North Korea proliferates everything under the planet. We don't have evidence that they have proliferated nuclear technology, but that's a concern. So obviously we're eliminating the biggest source for potential instability. And then economic benefits, you know, you've been hearing about these potential economic benefits that a unified Korea would be could be even more prosperous over the long term, right? We're talking about, and we can go through the list of that, right? Defense spending. Right now, South Korea spent $35 billion this year. But the reduced defense spending, conscription, there's mandatory conscription that's in South Korea, that they could be, these young men could be freer, earlier join the economy. the natural resources. North Korea is sitting on $6 trillion estimated, $6 trillion worth of natural resources. South Korea, meanwhile, imports 97% of its natural resources because they don't have any. So the list is long in terms of and the labor. South Korea is the fastest aging society, second fastest aging society in the world. Its life expectancy rate, which is about 81 years old right now, it's they're living longer now, which is a good thing. I want South Koreans to live longer, but it's a fast aging society. We have a relatively younger labor workforce in North Korea, so there's potential benefits. And you've seen that report about Goldman Sachs report in 2009, talking about how potentially unified Korea could become the next Germany of Asia. And you know, a lot of people sort of nitpick at this economic argument, but I don't underestimate the Korean people. After the Korean War, Korean Peninsula was completely devastated. In the early 60s, it was one of the poorest countries on the planet. It was poorer than Sudan and Bangladesh, Liberia. This is early 60s. And look what South Korea has accomplished. So I do believe in the Korean people. It'll be 75 million hardworking people. That's whole and free. So again, I'm not trying to say there's all these upsides and there's no negative downsides. It's that we are going to certainly face a lot of challenges, but there are also going to be benefits. Mm-hmm. And besides, we might not have a choice in the matter. It's not like we can choose, because out of all the potential scenarios of unification, soft landing scenario, which is what everybody wants, but frankly, candidly, I don't think it's all that likely that we are now looking at North Korea that's going to change and really reform itself and become this new country that its neighbors or its citizens can live with. I just don't see that happening. So far as I'm concerned, that's what we desire, but it's not necessarily most likely scenario. Or the other scenario of a unification through conflict or war. I also don't think that's necessarily likely scenario either. So most likely scenario in my mind is this hard landing scenario. We can't choose. It will just implode one day and we'll have to deal with it. So it comes back to then my original point, which is we have to start preparing for unification. We need to talk, we need to get engaged with, obviously US and South Korea needs to have this comprehensive plan, much more comprehensive than what it is. We need to start talking to the Chinese about this. China, it's very hard to talk to the Chinese about this. We've tried. We understand the reasons why. While China is not happy with Kim Jong-un, while China is certainly, you know, there's no love lost there. They have not been happy with North Korea for some time. We know that. Kim Jong-un is yet to visit Beijing. Xi Jinping is yet to go to Pyongyang when Xi Jinping had two very successful summits with President Park. So while China is not happy with North Korea, we know that still their priorities with North Korea is to keep it as a buffer against potential U.S. forces there, and we know that. So, but nonetheless, we have no choice but to try to engage with China, and that's where sort of the more controversial point about my piece came in, which is, you know, we could even try to offer a deal with the Chinese, which is that we know what your concerns are. Let's try to then, you know, make a deal and, you know, even promise that we might have to even withdraw all the U.S. troops, you know, case of unification. Because at the end of the day, we would have eliminated that threat, so we don't really need to be there. But that's a little bit controversial. But that was my bottom line, is that we need to start preparation. We need to, and not fear unification, you know, it's going to happen sooner or later.
Yeah.
And later might be even more problematic, because what would happen is North Korea is continually building nuclear weapons. They're continually honing their technology and building more fissile material and producing more fissile material, nuclear material. And so sooner is better than later. And we got to do what we can to prepare for it.
I think one of the interesting things with your piece, especially following on the statement by Pakane early in the year about this notion of unification benefits or bonanza, and the historic Dresden speech where she outlined in Germany for its important symbolic representation 25 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, you know, a call that takes into account some of the economics, some of the social realities, cost, and how to mend those, and speaks to potential benefits. Modeling Korea as perhaps something like a Germany in Northeast Asia. It seems to me that one of the things that your piece really gets to is that there is a legacy, a history of the Korean Peninsula unified, and that this period that we have had for six decades is actually
an anomaly.
An anomaly.
Yeah, yes.
And a shocking one at that. And that the cost has been tremendous.
Yes.
And I think what you have also suggested, both through the troop issue as well as the more general framework, is that people will have to move into a different direction. What's been established over six decades has provided a foundation for security and prosperity, and that the next stage of security and prosperity means some alteration of current arrangements and relationships.
Yes.
China, you mentioned. And so I guess I would ask you next, how do you see the other pinpoints in the year? The bonanza, the speech in Dresden, the bilateral presidential summit with Xi Jinping the summer, as shifting the context for the South Korean public as well for as the international community. How do you see the stage as being set? And I think your piece actually is an important contribution to what's happened this year.
Yes. First of all, you're absolutely right. You have to remember that Korea has been unified, was one single country from 668 AD when Silla Dynasty, Silla Kingdom unified the country. Until 1945, it was one country. Through the colonial years, it's been one country. So from 1945 to now, that division is a very short blip in the history of, in the Korean history. This is an anomaly that needs to be fixed. Now, in terms of preparation, I think President Park, it was very interesting to me that what, to be, you know, candid, why South Korea now started this focus on unification. It's coincided with my, I actually wrote the foreign affairs piece last year before the Dresden speech, but it kept getting postponed. But I think it's probably because after Chang Song-taek's execution, it really just made us, what my earlier point about, made us realize there's so much going on in North Korea, we just don't know. So I think there was that sort of shock of Chang Song-taek effect, and that younger generation in Korea, particularly the younger generation, is moving away from this goal of unification, right? Older generation, obviously, have some ties with North Korea. Many are from divided families. My entire paternal side came from North Korea. I lived through my personal whole histories. I was very close to my paternal grandparents, who all came from North Korea. And they eventually passed away without ever finding out what happened to their moms and dads and uncles and aunts. And so I lived this divided family story. But the younger generation in Korea is moving away from it, and because they're so fearful of the cost of the unification. They don't really have ties with North Korea. Who are these people? They could be people from another planet. They don't have, so younger generation is just, so I think the timing-wise, it's just, there's a Chang Song-taek's execution and the younger generation moving away from the unification. I think maybe, I can't speculate why Park government has been focused on unification, but I think they might have something to do with the renewed focus, at least coming from the South Korean side. And I think they're doing the right thing. I know that South Korea is, right now promoting unification or talking a lot about it with conferences and seminars and just different, they just have this new presidential committee on unification to educate people on trying to get them to get at least, again, not be fearful about unification, but to get excited a little bit about the potential for unification, to just say it's not going to be all bad. I just trying to really shift people's thinking a little bit on this issue.
What is some of the response that you've heard since the article was published in the July-August edition of Foreign Affairs?
I got a mixed response. I got a lot of people wrote me, and there was this very, very positive and said it was good. And then there is, of course, you know, the Korea community is divided, and there are folks who try to disagree with the piece. And I don't mean to point out Moon Jung-in, Professor Moon Jung-in and John Delury, but they did write response to this piece, which just came out in the latest Foreign Affairs.
Right.
So
and this is the
go
November,
and read that because it's the other side of the argument. And then I got an opportunity to write a rejoinder to that response. Mm-hmm. And I do believe, I think, I don't want to summarize, I don't want to, because they need, they will articulate this, their argument better, but I think the point is, they're worried that I'm overly focusing on the opportunities. The piece was focusing on opportunities of unification and not enough on the challenges of the unification. And that somehow I'm advocating a forceful change, a regime change. But that's mm-hmm. the furthest thing from the truth because, A, as I said, I'm not saying regime collapse is imminent. I don't know. I really don't. B, any kind of forceful change, that's not what I'm advocating. In fact, unification through force or war is the worst likely scenario. That's the last thing the world needs right now. So I'm not advocating that. Although, what I am saying is on balance, and again, as I said, I understand all the challenges that unification will entail. But on balance, over the long term, I think there will be more benefits. And so I guess that's sort of the argument, is that what's stronger? The challenges, there's going to be more challenges than benefits, or benefits or challenges? Again, we don't have choice in the matter. Mm-hmm. It is what it is, and we have to sort of, I guess I'll go even further. I'll be very candid. I'll go further because what I secretly want is unification. And while I'm not advocating forceful change, I am advocating, because on balance it's going to be not going to be better, A, let's not be fearful of it, and B, because if we're not going to be fearful of it, then we do what we can. And there are some things that we can do. We have very limited leverage. I get that. I mean, how can any outsider really make unification happen? But if you're not fearful of it, we can at least do what we can do, which is, number one, I think we have to start by helping the North Korean people. Again, not enough focus on the people and what's going on the whole humanitarian side, mm-hmm. human rights perspective. Stepping up the information campaign, information penetration campaign, right? Trying to get outside information. Step up our efforts to get outside information into North Korea to break down information blockade, Kim Jong-un's information blockade. Highlighting regime's abuses, widespread systemic abuses, which the UN, on a 400-page report this year called Crimes Against Humanity. Highlighting Gulag and other human rights abuses. And I'm all about, economic, this is controversial too, but continually step up our efforts to pressure economically at the elite level, right? Economic sanctions and economic pressure to cut off the fund that Kim Jong-un uses to buy luxury goods and luxury cars and cognac to continue getting support from the elite support. So because if you're not fearful of unification, we can do all these things while preparing for it by getting the region involved, by really talking to the regional governments, and especially China, which we talked about, number one patron to Kim Jong-un.
Let me close our part of the discussion with a question that sort of touches to some of the essential nature of this argument, and that is one that you just alluded to in the first part of your answer to the desire for unification. Often when I'm asked in classroom settings or in public presentations, what's one thing Americans don't really get or outsiders get about change on the Korean Peninsula, I often respond that they don't understand the desire for unification. We often overlook that because of other concerns, maybe important concerns, denuclearization, other issues, but that is an essential part of Korean existence during this historical anomaly, to use your words. And I know I was motivated to go into Korean studies, among other reasons, by standing near the DMZ and seeing elderly Koreans weep in their desire for what had been lost.
Right.
And I know that in advance of this discussion, one of our board members mentioned, his generations being the generation that dealt with the war years as having so deeply desired and being concerned now that there may be a passing before that time comes. Could you say a few words in terms of your impressions of that essential desire for unification, especially coupled with what you opened with about the resoluteness of the Korean people, what they have built in a matter of two generations,
right.
Which is really a modern miracle in many ways.
Right.
And I would maybe add as another personal observation that I was so impressed in 1997 and 98 by seeing the resoluteness to the response to the international financial crisis. I spent a lot of time in Korea then, and I was shocked and impressed by how much Koreans contributed. And
grandmother standing in line, taking up their gold rings
absolutely.
And putting in the...
And it said something to me about the resoluteness and what eventually would be a unification and integration period. Could you speak to that?
Yes, no, absolutely. So as I mentioned earlier, my paternal grandparents helped raise me. I was very close to them because my father passed away when I was young, and you know they helped raise me. And they were the lucky ones, right, because they happened to be in the southern part of the Korean Peninsula when the war broke out. But their families were not so lucky, right? There are other family members who remain trapped in North Korea, and as I mentioned, that they spent, that's all they talked about is trying to find out what happened to their family members. And I really, when I think about it, it's very personal to me. I truly, you know, sad at the fate of my family members and so many families like my family, divided families, and actually all the North Korean people. I wish they had the kind of opportunities that I had, or 50 million South Koreans have. These are the same people. I'm always shocked whenever I deal with North Korean defectors. They're like your cousin, your aunts, your uncles. They speak the same language. It's the most ethnically homogeneous country in the world. They share the same culture, same history for so many years. And this anomaly, this is truly an anomaly. So, younger generation don't know it, fine. But this is really the responsibility of Korean people. So what I can speak to is, let's not fear it. You have to believe in yourself. I do believe in the Korean people. You just mentioned just 2-3 decades. I was raised in 60s, even 70s, Park Chung-hee era, and I came to United States in early 1980s. But I just remember when I go back to Korea and I'm just shocked at just the transformation, the resoluteness and hardworking Korean people. So again, United Korea would have 75 million hardworking people. People talk, you know, a lot of naysayers talk about, oh, North Koreans are their indoctrination, it's gonna be really hard for them to adjust. It's true with North Korean defectors. And I'm not underestimating some long-term consequences of trying to unite the two Koreas that have been separated now for 60 years. There's no other history, even German unification. East and West Germany were not so different. Not as different as Korea's in terms of just separation, right? We've been separated for 6 decades in terms of ideology and everything else. But again, I have to say, if you just look at the historical record, South Koreans were able to do it. United Korea would be a bigger and better version of South Korea, be a whole Korea, and while freeing all the North Koreans, 25 million North Korean people.
Dr. Soo Terry, thank you. Please, a round of applause for Dr. Terry. Again, I'd like to thank our members of the board. I named a few before, but also to add Mark Gaston here, who has kindly spent his time today. And we appreciate so many members of the community who are working on these issues and issues like human rights. Please do join us again next Friday at noon for our next installation and our series called The Analyst. And I'd invite you to please have a look at the gallery on your way out at the current exhibition featuring items from Lee Snyder, our board member here today. And let me just in closing say that if you haven't seen yesterday's Wall Street Journal, one of the recommended picks for New York for the weekend is the film series at the Museum of the Moving Image, just about 10 minutes from here over the bridge. Please have a look and see our development team as well for membership at www.koreasociety.org. Thank you for coming today.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for information about memberships and to learn more about all the programs available at the Korea Society.